growth, too. For NPR News, I'm Lee Gaines.
Demonstrators across the country are expected to take part in No King rallies today to protest President Trump and his administration. Organizers say that events are scheduled in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia. For 35 years, sharing what works in schools today and working to inspire new ways to learn tomorrow. More at edutopia.org.
Well, it is that time once again, friends, the conversation on WVIK, a weekly celebration of local radio the way it's meant to be brewed. This week, my guest is Jen Lewis Snyder from the Quad Cities Cultural Trust. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll stick around for this week's conversation on WVIK. You know, my sense of time is all messed up, and I can't believe that I've been doing the show long enough that I get to have repeat guests. But Jen Lewis Snyder, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me back.
Well, it was one of the more interesting conversations I think we've ever had, because you are in the middle of so many cool things, and I can't wait to get to all those. But for those who may not have heard the last time you were on the program, give us a little thumbnail. Tell me about your life before the Cultural Trust.
I'm a born and raised Quad citizen. I've got three biological children. We have a blended family, so my husband has two boys, and I've got three, so we've got five together. And before the Cultural Trust, I was at United Way, so I've been able to have time in the nonprofit space with Health and Human Service and Art and Culture, and it's really influenced my perspective in philanthropy.
Well, United Way is a far-reaching organization. Mm-hmm. Was a lot of your work with cultural organizations, or were you doing a lot of different things with them?
So as soon as my grandmother, I spent a lot of time with her. My parents were very young when they had me. They actually were married before they graduated high school. Mm-hmm. And then right upon graduation, they had me. So I spent a lot of time with her. And when she had her stroke, I had just started college. And so I was prepared to drop out and, you know, take care of her.
Sure.
And United Way stepped in, and they had their day of caring, and they made her home wheelchair accessible and helped connect her with social services so she could get in-home care. And that really impacted me, seeing the way that the nonprofit sector intervened and helped when life happened. It changed me. I was on the business route. I wanted to go do something in fashion and, you know, all the things. And seeing, you know, my grandmother lived, you know, a modest life. She wasn't affluent enough to donate. So why was this nonprofit giving to her? You know, I didn't get it. So I really dove into that deeply, and I wanted to understand more about that space and also the efficiencies related to it. And that's really what I became passionate about in school. And then I applied to every United Way that was hiring because I wanted to learn more about it. And so my time right after graduation was about learning about the United Way system and how it worked and how it benefited the community.
Yeah. And now, even because, you know, QCCT, the Cultural Trust, has a backstory, too, before you came along. Tell us a little bit about the history of that organization and how it came together.
Yeah, next year, in 2027, the Cultural Trust turns 20 years
That's
old.
That's crazy.
I know. It's still so young, really, which is wild to me. But 20 years ago, we were on the cusp of Vision Iowa. And, you know, we had three real visionaries come together and say, if we want to sustain this progress, we need to endow some funds into the art and cultural sector. And that was Bechtel Trust, Hubble Waterman, and the John Deere Foundation. And they endowed $15 million and said, you know, let's raise $32 million so that we can, through dividend income, provide operational support for deeply rooted amenities. We'll do it in 2008. And then, of course, you know, the economy had a moment of pause and they said, we'll wait for a second. And then in 2018, after a feasibility study, Steve Balls, who we both know well and respect so much, was that the board chair at the time, and they did a feasibility study and said, okay, I think we're ready. And I was at United Way at that time, and I was not looking, but I think sometimes that's when the universe says, check this out. So it came looking for me. The position was introduced to me, and I was like, I don't know. I'm very passionate about the health and human sector, but I had a daughter who had sensory processing disorder. And Nora sang before she spoke, and she painted before she wrote. And so I saw the power of art and culture in her academia, in her dexterity, in her just development altogether, and what it did for her. And so maternally, I was pulled, I was gravitated to this position. And so I entertained it, I took it, and we aspired to raise $32 million by 2024 so that we could provide more than the dividend income to our legacy partners, who are Common Cord, Figge Art Museum, the Putnam Museum and Science Center, Quad City Arts, Quad City Botanical Center, and Quad City Symphony Orchestra. And we did it right before COVID. So we got to the goal early. We were able to distribute up to 5% of our portfolio at that time. And it was like the perfect, it was just the perfect thing to have happen during a very horrible, you know, tragedy, which was the pandemic. And we were able to keep our art and culture ecosystem alive in a time where other big, large, you know, communities that we are trying to compete against were not able to do the same thing. They weren't sustaining their amenities like we were.
Right. First, a little bit of philanthropy 101, if you don't mind. Why are endowments important? If I'm thinking to give $100 to an organization, I might want to support a project. I might want to support an endowment. Why are endowments important for not-for-profit organizations?
The best way that I describe it, it's like it's the savings account. You know, I mean, there's always going to be emergencies, right? And you need that checking account to be able to immediately pay those bills. But the endowment is in perpetuity. It's forever. This is a mechanism that forever will sustain art and culture in our region. So when you give to an endowment, you are saying, I want this to live beyond me. I want it to live for my children, for my children's children. I see the value of art and culture, and I want it to matter far beyond my lifetime. Mm.
That is great. And for the organization, I think it gives you a little bit of planning stability if you know that you're going to get that whatever 5% or whatever the spending policy is. And I've been at this organization long enough that I've seen that spend policy vary over time, a little more, a little less, but it's something that's very different from the operational budget. So,
yeah, unrestricted funds, the power of unrestricted funds. You know, that's another element of philanthropy that a lot of people don't digest. When you give to something specific and the nonprofit has to spend it in that narrow lane, are they grateful? Yes. But is it restricted? Yes. But when you can go to that nonprofit, the experts in that realm, and say, do what you need to.
Right, right. Yeah,
it's a freeing thing.
Yeah.
You know, and the sky's the limit. You know, you're putting them in a think tank and saying, you're the expert. Invest this properly. Make the world a better place with it, and they're free to do what they need to with the funds.
Right, right. And it's interesting, the organizations that are part of your legacy partners, they run the gamut of larger, smaller, medium, that kind of thing. I get to serve on the board of the Martin Luther King Community Center, and we're just trying to get an endowment started. It is a shift in I think attitudes, expectations, and all that sort of stuff. But we aspire to great organizations like the Quad City Symphony Orchestra, the Botanical Center, and others. So you've mentioned those legacy partners, but the trust has grown. You've added some partners, right?
So we have added the Adler Theater Fund, which allows us to support non-legacy partners. Our legacy partners are also in perpetuity. We have identified these institutions as so essential to the community that we will forever fund them. We're in a marriage, if you will. And but we've absorbed the Adler Theater Fund, and it allows us to begin a courtship with other nonprofits in the community, you know, so they can get to know what it's like to work with the cultural cultural trust. And as we continue to grow our corpus, now we're able to say, okay, let's engage in this rhythm together. And then when our corpus grows, then we can add more legacy partners. Also, shout out to Jerry Jones, because he was with me at United Way.
Yeah.
And I adore him. He's a wonderful leader at MLK. So.
Well, I'm going to raise your Jerry Jones praise and say that I knew him when he was a student.
So stop it.
Absolutely.
Oh, my gosh.
Absolutely. He's a great leader. We're very fortunate to have him. Well, let's talk a little bit about then governance. So your board, I would assume, has some representation from the partners, but then are there general members who are just not related to any of these? How does that work?
Yeah, it's another unique element of the cultural trust. So our majority shareholders are our recipients. So every single legacy partner has a seat on our board. So because we have six legacy partners, until our legacy partner list grows, our board will never grow from 11. Seats, which is great. But, you know, you can also think of the idiosyncrasies with that. You know, they have to wear two hats. They have to represent and advocate for their institution that they represent, but also the cultural trust. So balance is everything in our world. We talk about it all the time.
Right. And I know that. I get to do a little bit of programming for other organizations on governance. And it's the hardest thing for a human to do, because we are made up of our passions. But when you're at that board table, the hat you're wearing is entirely loyal to that table, that organization. And you have to press everything aside and say, this is what's best for this organization, even if on another day I'm at another table with maybe a conflicting interest.
That's
right?
Exactly
so
right.
So it's tough. It's tough. But so that leads to my next question. You have to be kind of an expert in all these fields, and they're not all arts related. You mentioned that you've got the Botanical Center, very science oriented, the Putnam science and history and humanities oriented. How has it been? Is it an ongoing learning curve or how did you get yourself up to speed on all these gigs?
I am not an expert in all of it, and I don't pretend to be, you know, and that's the awesome thing about this job is that I get to work with the experts and, you know, I get to learn from them. I think that, you know, the thing about this job is we know our unique talent, and our unique talent is convening the experts and bringing them together and fostering collaboration and avoiding duplication and harnessing their unique talents and their expertise to say, how can we lift this? How can we keep the ecosystem balanced, but leverage all of our unique talents in a way that make this community a great place to live, work, and play?
Well, okay, we're going to shift gears a little bit, because I want to talk to you about something that's not directly related to the cultural trust, but you just tapped into this. And this is the danger of being on the conversation, Jen. You have no idea where I'm going to go. But what you just described is it is an endorsement of something I've long believed, that if we can stay curious, especially as we age, and I've got quite a few more rotations around the sun on you, but if we can stay curious, that's about 90% of the battle against cynicism, judgmentalism, all these kinds of things. What are some examples in your life when being curious has served you well?
That's a great question. Every single day on this job, my husband has a phrase with our children, 1% better every single day. And I think about it all the time. You know, this job has pushed everything in me, because I'm not the expert in it all, right? And so it requires, you know, if you want to provide unrestricted funds and you want to be the best CEO for the cultural trust, it requires you to convene those experts and talk about all the things. And it requires, you know, making sure that they feel safe at the table, that they feel valued at the table, that their vested interest is acknowledged, and that, you know, everyone is getting, it's a mutually beneficial partnership. And that curiosity is something that I have to lean into all the time. What do you need out of this?
Yeah.
You know, what does your organization need? Where's the gap? How can we find it? And our application for the cultural trust, I would say, is one of the most curious ways that we have won in this region. We found a way to monetize partnership, to really lean into it, to change the psychology of what we are doing when we're funding. You know, fostering collaboration, that word, it's it's something that is hard to do because you have to stay in your lane and it's easy to build those silos and you've all got your own boards that you have to answer to. And in our application process, our legacy partners are ranked based on how authentically and organically they are working together. Not forced, but in their testimony to us, where was the unique space where you leaned into your expertise and you found a way to partner together? I'll give you an example. The Putnam aspires to bring the first ever dinosaur to the state of Iowa, permanent dinosaur, Triceratops. They're digging it up right now for the second year. And the Symphony had Jurassic Park. They scored Jurassic Park last year. That was a unique organic partnership. The conductor of the Symphony helped dig up the dinosaur in Wyoming. That, I mean, talk about authenticity.
Oh, yeah.
That would not have happened if you wouldn't have fostered that conversation. But getting them in a room together and knowing that by going together, you're going to get more unrestricted funds because it's good business, you know?
Yeah.
That it's a good thing to be curious about one another. That's the best example that I can give you.
That's a fantastic example. And the funny thing is, the reason I'm snickering is I've had a chance to talk with Mark Russell Smith, the conductor, music director of the Quad City Symphony Orchestra. And it's one of the coolest things to watch his eyes light up when this guy who devotes so much of the 24 hours of a day to studying deeply the music he's going to share with us. I mean, mm-hmm. Music is the focus, and yet he was out in Wyoming digging up a Triceratops. I mean, it's phenomenal. And I must say, I think there were a couple of Augustana students along on that dig, too.
That's very true. And, yeah. You know, my favorite part of that story is when they were talking about the first phase of the dig, because, you know, they have other groups going and digging, mm-hmm. you know, aspiring to bring a dinosaur to their community. We found 8 dinosaur bones on our dig.
Mm.
And they—
Did you go?
No, but, you know, it's a we, right?
I'm going to make it a we. Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
It's a we. It's a we lift. but we found 8 dinosaur bones, and that was the most that a group found that summer. And so they were saying, boy, the Midwest, the Quad Cities, they work hard. Everybody else found 1 or 2.
Yeah.
But on our dig, we were working real hard for our bones. So I found that so awesome that, you know, not only— we didn't just check the box when we went, right?
Yeah.
Even our symphony orchestra leaders, they were out there digging, really wanting to find the bones. And I think it was actually Mark Russell Smith who found the tail of the Triceratops, and it had a bite from a T-Rex.
Oh, my.
So now we've got a whole story.
I love it.
So good.
All right, let me be a paleontological nerd for a minute. You know, we've got Cryolophosaurus eleoti. Don't worry, I won't make you say that.
Not an expert in that now, Ty.
At Augustana, and it was the first one unearthed in Antarctica. And when they found it, Dr. Bill Hammer and his students, they noticed there was a rib bone in the site that was not the dinosaur in question. Mm. And so they deduced that our dinosaur choked to death. It was gulping down this other animal. And the funny thing was, 13 years later, Dr. Hammer got NSF funding to go back down to Antarctica. And within minutes, his team were looking in the right place, which was nearby, but not exactly adjacent. They found the prey dinosaur.
Oh my gosh.
And so that's now Glaciosaurus hammeri.
So cool.
I know. I just nerd out on stuff like this. Anyway, you talk about the partnerships, and I love that phrase, monetizing being good neighbors or being partnering. And I love seeing, if I go to an event at Common Court and, hey, there's Ryan Willey, or I go over to the Botanical Center and, my goodness, there's Brian Baxter, and was just at the Figgy. The Figgy was helping kick off this Violins of Hope.
Yes.
That's bringing so many organizations together. And yeah, I think you're right. It's not that you say, it's not like a bribe, do this and get money, but you're leading them to see how that authentic kind of cooperation really pays off in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. I mean, even my shirt today, it's— have you seen Raven?
I don't know this one. What is this?
It is an exhibition at the Figgy that we have until August.
That's right. Thank
you. And it is, you know, Preston Singletary came to the Quad Cities.
Yes.
I did not know that he is the longest running Alaskan artist to have this type of exhibition, this successful, and we have it right here in the Quad Cities.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have not gone, it is poetically wonderful. And everyone that goes through, I say, you know, give me one word. How did you feel?
Yeah.
What did you get out of it? Because it's 2 floors.
Yeah.
It's a true experience.
Yeah.
It's the story of the raven.
Yes. It's so cool because I know just a little bit about Tlingit culture and mm-hmm. everything along what you would imagine sort of the Alaska panhandle and west coast of Canada. And it's just amazing. And now you're shaming me because I haven't gotten over yet, but I got to get over.
Well, you've been a busy guy. You'll get there. You'll get there.
That's my hope. That is certainly my hope. Okay, so I want to try to give equal love to everybody here in terms of our mentions.
Welcome to my world, by the way.
What I want to ask you about in the partnership side, you did something a year ago or so where everybody got together for a big party at Schwiebert Park.
Yes.
Are you going to do something like that?
Culture
Bright.
Yes, Culture Bright. It's a new word. Everyone's like, what is Culture Bright? Culture Bright. We kicked it off in November of 2024. And really what it is, you know, it's mutually beneficial moments for the ecosystem, right? The Cultural Trust doesn't need to have our own events. We have six institutions that do amazing things. We all share the same constituents. So we lean in together and we partner on that because guys like Kai Swanson are really busy. So we don't want to fill up their calendar. So Culture Bright is sort of the work coming to life. And we absolutely plan on having a summer Culture Bright series. We're going to have a winter Culture Bright series where we position our legacy partners as centric in it, and we showcase the amazingness that is our ecosystem.
Well, what I was so pleased with is that, among other things, the you mentioned the fall thing, which was great, great fun. But the summer gig that you did, you brought it to Schwiebert Park. And what's one of the battles that lifelong residents of the Quad Cities know all too well, and that is getting people to come south across the river. We all go north across the river on the regular, but thank you for bringing folks to Schwiebert Park. It's really a gem in our community.
It's lovely, and adjacent to Schwiebert Park is Arts Alley,
right?
Which we love as well. So it's they complement one another, and you know we love being able to dovetail, you know, exhibitions or concerts, you know, to be able to say we're going to kick off over here and then we're going to volley right back over there.
And the Botanical Center had a bus. And the symphony had instruments.
Yes.
The first time in my life, I dragged a bow across violin strings.
You did the petting zoo.
I did the symphony petting zoo.
Yes. Lovely.
It was a great idea.
Which one did you like the best?
I'm not picking favorites. Okay. I loved them all. Okay. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't there an artist there named Sarah Robb who was doing a little art project?
Yes.
When we come back, we're going to take a break here in just a minute, but when we come back, I want to talk about other partnerships you've got going with Sarah Robb, who is an amazing artist in our community and grateful for everything you do. I do want to take just a quick minute to let people know if you are looking for something to do today, and this is for folks who are listening to us on the Saturday morning live portion. Saturday morning. This afternoon is a little gig going on over at LeClaire Park in Davenport. It's a community calendar note, shall we say, for anybody who prefers democracy over monarchy. It's the No Kings Rally. Indivisible Quad Cities is partnering with many other local organizations. They're going to be gathering at 1 o'clock, and they ask that you come to the picnic shelter in LeClaire Park, not the bandstand, but the picnic shelter. You can arrive between 1 and 1:45, and then folks will be fanning out in a visibility action across most sidewalks in downtown Davenport. Power of the People. That's also kind of subtext of what I'm talking about. My guest this week is Jen Lewis-Snyder, the president of the Quad Cities Cultural Trust. We're going to be back in just a moment. We will remind you, however, that you're listening to The Conversation on WVIK. Stay tuned, friends. More to come.
Support for WVIK, Quad Cities NPR, comes from the Regional Development Authority, distributing funds from the Rhythm City Casino Resort to help make the Quad Cities a more vibrant and inclusive community. Learn more at rdauthority.org.
Kick off your weekend with What's Happening QC, your guide to concerts, festivals, and events around the Quad Cities, made possible by Seifert Building Supplies. Fridays at 8:01 a.m. on WVIK Classical. And remember, subscribe to What's Happening QC wherever you get your podcasts. What's Happening QC?
I'm Steve Anditch from Rock Island, and WVIK is my NPR station.
Welcome back to The Conversation on WVIK, and I certainly am enjoying this chat with our guest this week, Jen Lewis-Snyder from the Quad Cities Cultural Trust. Okay, so we were talking about you're bringing people into Rock Island, you're bringing these partnerships together, you're doing these amazing things, and I name-dropped Sarah Robb.
Yes.
Now, what other kinds of collaborations have you got going with that amazing local artist?
Well, one special thing about Sarah Robb, you know, she has been integral in the student mural project at Quad City Arts. And so every time the Cultural Trust has had a milestone, we have retained her to help us tell that story. We have a mural on the side of the Common Core building when we hit 32 million. And she's done a lovely job of seeing our evolution. And so when the Botanical Center launched Storybook Garden, I found myself wanting to help tell that story. You know, every legacy partner has a gift shop. Mm-hmm. And when guests leave, you want to leave them with something that they can take home with them to remind themselves of the amazing time that they had, because we want them to come back. You cannot see our institutions in one shot. You know, that it's supposed to be a continuous relationship where you go back time and time again. So I went home that night and I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I stayed up all night and I wrote a book. And Gracie May Goes to the Garden. And there was only one person that I thought could thoughtfully illustrate the book, and that was Sarah Robb. So we did a collab together. And Gracie May Goes to the Garden is the collab, and it will be in the bookstore, in the gift shop at the Botanical Center this spring. And we aspire to have a book for every single legacy partner to help properly tell their story and leave guests with something so that they can go home and, you know, read that story to their kiddos and, you know, talk about the next time they're going to go mm-hmm. to that mm-hmm. institution. But it's a fun partnership.
And then eventually do these for the others as well.
Yes, Paisley's going to the Putnam. And Levi and Lily are going to go look at the lights at the Figgy. So, yes, we have lots of plans for all the books, and they're really fun, short stories that are easy reads, but just a fun way to engage with kiddos about the importance of art and culture and the civic pride we have about the institutions that we have.
And now, are you writing these?
Yes.
You write all of them?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I can't wait to read them to grandkids. This will be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
We've now 5 of the 8 are within striking distance of the Quad Cities.
Okay.
Or 6 of the 8. I'm sorry. Get your math right, Grandpa. But we'll work on the other ones as well. So, well, that's really cool. And what a wonderful idea. So it gives people a chance who've never been to the Botanical Center to feel like they... well, hopefully want to go.
Yes. I mean, if you haven't been, you can have the book, you can gift the book, right? And it also allows for you to leave a guest with something so that you can continue to perpetuate that narrative that go back and see us again. You can't see it all in one shot. And, you know, there is this evolution of, you know, newness at the institutions, and we want you to continue to discover.
Yeah. Well, I want to pause for a minute and give a shout out to Ryan Willey and the team at the Botanical Center, because of the groups, all of these groups are amazing and they have great stories, but I really hope somebody at some point tells the story of the Botanical Center. It started out, it was a great idea, a great concept, a great way to bring people south across the river and check things out. But there was a time, and this goes back 20 years or more, so don't worry about the players aren't there or anything else like that. But there was kind of this thought that one funder would meet the hole every year and fill the deficit and keep things going. And it left a kind of a moribund nature to programming. And I credit that funder with saying at one point, okay, you got 2 years and we're not going to do this anymore. You're going to have to figure out a way to do it. And there was great, fantastic leadership, even before Ryan got there, where they started to hustle. And Ryan is nothing if not, I mean, I think his middle name's got to be Hustle, because he's everywhere.
Oh my gosh.
He's doing everything. The lights that they do in the winter, the programming they do all year round, Discovery, Storybook Gardens. It's a place where I know from grandparenting experience, it's one of the best places to take our little friends at any time when the weather's nice or when the weather's not so nice. You can go in and warm up. I guess what I can turn this into the Cultural Trust. You've got organizations that have, I mean, these are all fantastic, but some that have been superlative. I mean, A++++ is part of the hope that they'll share some of that mojo with others and, well, the techniques and the learnings and everything like that.
Yeah, and I'm glad that, you know, leave it on the Botanical Center. I like talking about our legacy partners. It's why we're in business. Mm-hmm. You know, the Botanical Center is a great example of what happens when you lean in to your unique expertise.
Yeah.
Finding a way to stay relevant when it is winter in the Midwest. You know, activating your gardens in a way where you have 300,000 lights and you invite the public to come consume that, mm-hmm. rather than leaning out and saying, well, it's winter.
Yeah.
That's a scarcity mindset, and it's mm-hmm. not the Botanical Center. The Botanical Center is constantly asking 1% better. What can we do? How can we be better? And that is Ryan Willey.
Yeah.
He is absolutely the type of guy who wants to know what the solution is to the next thing. How can we continue to evolve? The plant bus is a great example of that. You know, post-pandemic, we were having a strategic retreat about what are we going to do? The schools are catching up. They can't do field trips. This is a problem. And mm-hmm. Ryan said, this is a solution. We're going to go to them. And we're not just going to go to them. When we go to them with this plant bus and we recreate the field trip on their site, we're going to have a conversation about when they can come visit us again. We'll come to you now. You come to us in 3 years. And now we're creating these long-term relationships with the schools that we did not have pre-pandemic. I mean, he has re-engineered a more sophisticated long-term relationship with the school districts that's serving thousands more children in a more engaging way. That when Ryan and Heather are going to conferences, there, when he's walking down, you know, the halls, they're like, are you the plant bus guy? We have the only plant bus in the country. I mean, it's innovative. It, mm-hmm. And partnering with, you know, Metrolink to say, okay, this bus is not needed here anymore. I'll take it. And I'm going to re-engineer it to be a botanical center, a mobile botanical center. It's just the thing, you know, it's the thought that anything is possible.
Yeah.
Is what a true leader has, and he's got it.
Yeah. You mentioned that phrase, scarcity mindset. What I want to ask you about is, since the last time you were on the program, mm-hmm. the current presidential administration and its supporters in Congress have changed the math a lot for science, all kinds of STEM, cultural arts, the way that the federal government interacts with those. And many organizations, like this one that we're talking on right now as being a public radio station, have had to deal with enforced scarcity. And I would agree with you that you can't take a scarcity mindset to that. But what is your counsel, or what are you hearing when you bring these leaders together about dealing with a rapidly changing environment?
Yeah, we you know, the response that we, you know, we came together and we agreed a rising tide lifts all boats, right? And we've got something that we all share on a post-it that is fact over feeling. So the fact is, when we come together, we see better results. And so what we have been doing is collaborative fundraising. Going to a donor with seven institutions at a table and saying, this is our best. This is what we've got. And you, as the philanthropist, should invest what you want. You know, it's your money in the first place, but we would like to bring you our best and we would like you to give us yours, you know, rather than just a tiny bit. We want you to truly invest in what this is because we see real value here. We're having more deep, meaningful conversations with donors together. But for the first time ever, seven institutions are going into the room together, egos aside, silos down, saying, this is about the greater good. Mm-hmm. This is about cultural vitality, because we're not going to wait for it to get fixed in Washington. We're not going to wait for legislation to change. The cultural trust has always been built on the private sector. You know, it was always privately built and privately maintained. And so when things became what they were, we looked at each other and said, we've got this. We've always had it. Let's go out together and let's talk about what we do best, which is working together to create cultural vitality. There's a value in this, and let's invite the private sector to invest in it together.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because there is a lot of economic energy that comes from the arts and from STEM organizations and that kind of thing. Recently, Visit Quad Cities released some survey data that showed we are way above the norm in terms of citizens' support for the visitor economy, that it's okay to bring people in. Some communities don't like tourism as much or think they've already got too much of it. But what really stood out in those data for Visit Quad Cities is how open Quad citizens are to welcoming people to treasures like, the Common Core and Figge, Putnam, so on and so forth. How do you think that informs the work of the trust and its partner agencies?
Our legacy partners are so involved in making sure that tourism is, you know, in the forefront, but also that civic pride is a part of it. And that is why, you know, the results were what they were. Mm. We did a study simultaneous to that about, for every dollar we're investing locally in these institutions, what's the return on that investment? What's the average return on that investment? And it was a $20 return, you know, from early education to graduation rates to academia to tourism. What were we seeing in our region, for every dollar, it was some institutions, it was a $34 return on investment,
wow.
But the average was $20.
Wow.
Which is amazing.
Well, a lot of things happen when you get to civic pride. And one way you can enhance and culture or acculturate your civic pride is if you learn more about the great stories of your past, which is a very clunky segue to this week's edition of Rock Island Lines with Dr. Roald Tweet.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. Have you ever regretted a decision that seemed absolutely right at the time? Here's a local example. In 1816, United States troops from St. Louis built Fort Armstrong on a bluff at the western tip of Rock Island, one of five forts built on the upper Mississippi to protect the American fur trade. When Fort Armstrong closed in 1836, the island became the prize in a tug of war between military and civilian interests. Squatters were already encroaching on the island by 1836. As early as 1805, Lieutenant Zebulon Pike stopped at the island on an exploratory trip and recommended it be reserved for military purposes. It had water power, transportation, and the safety of being in the middle of the river. By the 1850s, however, many congressmen had sided with local constituents and were recommending that the island be turned over to the squatters, who now included not only farmers, but woodenware factories, sawmills, and even a small community. At this point, one man became a strong advocate for reserving the island for military purposes. He had served here briefly as a young captain in the Black Hawk War and knew the advantages of the location, an especially safe place for a federal arsenal. First as a United States Senator in 1850, and again in 1854 as the Secretary of War, he was instrumental in resisting the bills that called for its sale. Rock Island, he wrote, is one of the most advantageous sites in the whole Western country for an armory or an arsenal. He was right. Following John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, Congress authorized a new national arsenal on the island where it could be safe. From a single building begun in 1862, Rock Island Arsenal has become the largest arsenal in the world. In 1863, the Union erected a prison for Confederate soldiers on the island, the notorious Rock Island Barracks mentioned in Gone with the Wind. Nearly 2,000 of these prisoners lie buried on the island. To whom do the arsenal and the prison owe their existence? To the man who later became president of the Confederate States, Jefferson Davis.
Rock Island Lines with Roald Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And we get to hear that calliope and that wonderful local history each and every week because Rock Island Lines has a home on WVIK. If it's important to you to have a public radio station in your own backyard, then even though the fund drive is done, and by the way, thanks to everybody who made a pledge of support during the fund drive and exceeded the goal, but the need continues. If you go to WVIK.org, you can always tap that donate button. And we'd be most pleased. But thanks to Roll Tweet and Rock Island Lines, and thanks to my guest, Jen Lewis Snyder, the president of the Quad Cities Cultural Trust. You said something a minute ago. I love that phrase, fact over feeling. Mm-hmm. One that I use when I'm having a chance to work in higher ed groups with colleagues at colleges and universities around the country is somewhat akin to that. It's principles before personalities, right? So, but here's the thing, you're hip deep in arts and creative communities and scientific communities, and sometimes those passions make for interesting personalities. So I'm not asking you to dish, or I mean, maybe if an ounce of tea spills, I don't know. But how is it to negotiate very passionate people and to get them coming together?
Well, you know, I recruited a hostage negotiator on my board, so.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I did. His name's Tracy Pugh, and I did. He's no longer on my board.
Well, I know Tracy.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful person.
Yes, yeah. He is. Did you know he was a hostage negotiator?
Well, I knew he worked in the corrections field.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that was part
of his training. He actually just left my board because his responsibilities as Henry County's hostage negotiator are so intense that
Good
he
heavens.
Could no longer do both. But no,
yeah.
It's good for me.
Mm-hmm.
I am a very planful type A person, and I've got Nora, my daughter Nora is big into theater, and my daughter Lily is big into art, and you know, those frontal cortex enthused brains sometimes, you know, need mom to work in different ways than I'm used to.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really good for me to be able to, like, bring the agenda in and then crumple up the paper and throw it out and be like, okay, we're actually going to just paint on the wall today because everybody's in a different vibe.
Mm.
But it's about being nimble. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's made this build so special is we listen. It is fact over feeling, but it's also about listening and staying nimble and knowing and reading the room. You know, what does everybody need in this moment? What do the leaders need for each organization? What does each organization need? It's not about everybody, you know, getting their way.
Mm-hmm.
It's about everybody getting heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's why, you know, we've got the trust and the health that we do in the ecosystem.
You mentioned earlier this ranking. I assume that's just a recognition of the fact that any organization of any kind is always going to be somewhere on a spectrum of progress, stasis, maybe retrograde action, and you have to kind of assess that. When do you, or I should say, in working with your board, when does the board decide time to put the foot on the gas or maybe pump the brakes or something like that? How do those conversations unfold and how do you tee them up?
So our aspiration is to get every legacy partner to 20% of their vital expenses. Until we can afford to do that with our corpus, we do a spring application process where we rank our legacy partners based on their authenticity of partnership. You know, are they diversifying their revenue streams or are they using hope as a strategy? The answer is no, none of them are. They're all doing amazing work there. You know, what's the health of the partnership? What is the return on the investment? I was telling you how the average is $20, but some were at $34.
Yeah.
We're tracking that in real time. So
yeah.
We take all of that data, fact over feeling, and we rank them 1 through 6. Rather than scoring them, because everybody scores differently, you know, every teacher grades differently, but ranking is easy. You know, if the data is there and you're able to say, okay, here the data shows this person did the best here and this organization did the best here, you can 6-5-4-3-2-1 something relatively easy. That is how we pay out The spring application.
Right. Yep. And I didn't realize that was the goal, is to get to the corpus at such a level that everybody's getting 20% of their ops, which would be fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, and why 20%? We partnered with John Deere on a study, and we looked at the financial relationship between a recipient and a grantor. When you are in a forever funding relationship with an institution, what is a healthy, meaningful, unrestricted amount that you can annually give that doesn't manipulate the mission? Mm-hmm. Because if it's unrestricted, it should fulfill them with jet fuel to do what they want to do, not what do we need to do for the money. And 25% was the magic number. If you exceeded a quarter of their budget, whether it was unrestricted or not, you began to see the organization, you know, tweak things for your institution's preferences. We don't want that. You know, we want them to do what they need to do because they're the experts in their realm. So we've capped it at 20 and said, we want to get you all to 20%. We want a healthy, unrestricted financial relationship with you. And then we want to partner on other things together.
Yeah. Okay. I also know this about you, Jen Lewis-Snyder. You are an event planner par excellence. What's on your? I mean, you've invited me to some really cool parties. What's on the horizon? Is there anything you can tell us about fun stuff that's coming up?
We've got some really cool stuff. We just finished Time Traveler's Ball for the Putnam. That was epically amazing. The Figgy has a very cool Raven.
Yes, we got the Raven party going.
Party happening in June. So if you want to,
Tell us about that in June.
Yes, it is their it's their gala, and it is in June, and it is going to be amazing. They've got an outstanding volunteer committee that's already plotting just the best things ever. But they took the committee through the Raven exhibit for inspiration, so you can imagine it's going to be incredible. And the Figgy has a master mixologist, Nicole. She is...
Oh, a bartender.
Yes. Oh, no, it's a... Well, no,
I'm not hip.
It's all... It's mixology, because, and here's why I'm going to tell you that, because Nicole is able to curate a menu where you are able to smell and see and taste something that is on theme. When the soiree was at the Figgy and we did 007, Nicole made 007 limoncello shots and I was giving out truth serum. And if you did not take it, then you would have to answer any question that was asked truthfully.
You are so good at parties.
It's on theme. You have to give people a full immersive experience. You know, I mean, come on. If it's not fun, why are we doing it?
That's a riot. So those are some fun things to look forward
to.
Now, earlier in our conversation, you were very kind to share about Nora and how her exploration of arts was informative to you. And now you mentioned she's in theater.
Yeah.
Is that discovery still continuing? Do you mind giving us an update as to what she's doing now?
Yeah. So Nora, Nora's in seventh grade. She graduated out of her IEP in sixth grade, which was a very big deal for
mom.
I was very rigid. Hold on, are you sure we're ready, everybody? And they were like, yes, mom, we're ready. Nora got all A's and one B.
Way to go.
For seventh grade so far. And it was science. And, you know, mom, it's really hard. So, yes, I know. She participated, you'll appreciate this, at Augustana. She participated in the Penguin Project as a mentor. Which it was really cool to get to see her, you know, help others. Now, we're still working on some of our empathy. So, for you know, she is in the company at Center for the Living Arts. So she's been blessed to be able to do some lead roles, and she loves theater. She can't get enough. But in the mentor role, she was Queen Aduna because she was Queen Aduna for Frozen. And I'm like, you know, Nora, is this fulfilling for you? You know, are you getting something out of mentoring someone? Well, they didn't even give me a new role. You know, I'm not even expanding my talent. I'm like, well, this is a little bit more than that, sweetie. This is about helping one another, you know? So we're still working on that frontal cortex, but...
But I like her style. I like her style.
But God bless her for wanting to just... Oh, but sure. Her aspiration is to be on Broadway, you know?
Absolutely.
I mean, she's found her specialty and she loves it and... She sings like an angel, and she's
thank
just
heavens we have the Hazes here and so many opportunities in the choir. I got to get them on the show. I really have to get them on the show. So I didn't warn you about this, but you might remember from last time. One of the things I'm incurably curious. Are you reading anything fun these days that you might care to recommend to the rest of us?
I'm reading so many children's books. Really, just because I have an 8-year-old and I want to make sure that everything we're doing for the Legacy Partners with these books, you know, hits properly. So Henry and I are reading all of, you know, the children's books. He is obsessed with all of the pidgin books right now. So really we're focused on sight words and the integration of sight words into children's books. So I know that's a very boring answer.
No, no.
But that's...
Do you get any mom reading done?
That's, yeah, right.
And but, I understand if you don't.
Yeah, so. no mom reading. But I did just... Another cool thing that we have within our ecosystem is we book share, just like, you know, Goodreads that we have found. And Melissa Moore, the executive director at the Figgy, she just sent an email to us about some books that she really, really loved that she was going to share with us. So I am on the cusp of about to read some books. I was going to try to pull them up if I could.
As you're looking, our book club at Augustana, we finished George Saunders' Vigil. And it is an interesting book in that nobody really enjoyed it.
Oh, no.
But like 2 weeks after you read it, it's still in your head.
Haunting.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah?
Well, these are the two that I've got that I'm about to read. New Power.
Okay.
By Henry Timms and Atomic Habits.
Oh, I've heard so much about Atomic Habits. The one word, so just so you know, this book club is for fiction only because we all have to read so many management and other types of books and that kind of thing. So we're now reading Hamnet, which was made into a movie, which I haven't seen.
Okay.
And then I heard on NPR, where else, they were talking about the, Project Hail Mary. And somebody was saying, you know, I want to go read the book first. And in this instance, the majority opinion is, if you haven't read the book, go see the movie first and then maybe read the book later. But what about any other kind of media? Are you watching shows that I should know? Because I don't ever follow those kinds of things.
Well, I will say, I did just finish The Outsiders. I read it and watched the book because Nora was watching it and reading it for seventh grade. So I wanted to, we do a lot of dinner time conversation. I want to be relevant to my children.
Well, sure. Remind me, I think I should know that. Is that
The Outsiders? That's Patrick Swayze.
Yes, they made a movie.
Yes, and it's required reading for all the kiddos. The book is, so, you know, Pony Boy,
you know, Ralph Macchio.
Yes, yes. And, you know, there's all of these, you know, undertones in the book that you can read into. And so, you know, we're talking about all these literary undertones. And, you know, are you a social...
Yeah, right.
You know, are you what are the
It was all the clicks,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So here's my response to that. I don't know about you, but when I think back on it at Rock Island High School back in the late 70s, I was the chameleon. I could slide into and out of any group.
Yeah.
Couldn't hang with the jocks too long because it was pretty obvious that I wasn't one of those. But other than that, had a lot of fun doing that. Well, oh my goodness, Jen Lewis Snyder, thank you for being here. Can you believe we're out of time again?
I can, because time flies when you're having fun. So thank you for having me, and have a great rest of your Saturday.
Well, thank you. And we extend that wish to everybody who's listening right now. And again, thank you, Jen Lewis Snyder. And remember, friends, you can catch the conversation twice each week on WVIK, Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, right after, before Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is next. Then there's that rebroadcast Monday evenings at 8, right after Fresh Air. You can also find all recent episodes at WVIK.org. Just go looking for us under the podcast tab, if you will. From the campus of Augustana College, this is Kai Swanson inviting you to join us next week for the conversation on WVIK, when our guest will be Rachel Loomis from Living Lands and Waters. Right now, stay tuned. We'll have a little bit of news from NPR in Washington in a minute or two, and then it's Wait, Don't Tell Me. Thank you for tuning into The Conversation on WVIK.
You've been listening to a rebroadcast of The Conversation on WVIK. If you liked what you heard, you can catch new episodes on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. or back here again next Monday. Thanks for listening. Support for Quad Cities NPR, WVIK, comes from Aunt Rhody's Landscaping and Design Studio in Eldridge.
Designing and installing landscapes to include patios, fire pits, ponds, outdoor lighting, and more. A full scope of services and scheduling consults is available at antrodies.com.
I'm Ann Bowden from Rock Island, Illinois, and WVIK is my NPR station.
With national and international news at the top of every hour and local news throughout your day, we're WVIK, 90.3 FM and HD Rock Island, and at 95.9 FM, K240DZ Dubuque, WVIK, Quad Cities NPR.